Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now in Psalms chapter 62. I will entitle this psalm, My Soul Waits for God Alone. The heading of this psalm states this, For the director of music for Jeduthun, a psalm of David. Well, we know this is a Davidic psalm, so I will refer to David as we go through the psalm. Again, the headers are not necessarily scripturally inerrant, but I see no problem in assuming that they are correct. Now, who is this Jeduthun? He was one of the chief singers of the Levites, of the Levitical singers. We read this in 1 Chronicles 16:41-42. With them were Heman and Jeduthun. I love that name. Heman, the co-singer of Jeduthun. Apparently, Heman didn't have any problem with gender confusion. With them were Heman and Jeduthun, and the rest who were chosen and were designated by name to give thanks to the Lord, because his loving kindness is everlasting. And with them were Heman and Jeduthun with trumpets and cymbals for those who should sound aloud, and with instruments for the songs of God, and the sons of Jeduthun for the gate. So Jeduthun's sons handled the gate, Jeduthun himself handled the trumpets and the cymbals. They were designated by name. And so we assume if they're handling the trumpets and cymbals, they're in charge of the music. And remember, these psalms were songs to be sung. So we start now in Psalms 62, verses 1 through 4. David says this, I am at rest in God alone. My salvation comes from Him. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. I will never be shaken. How long will you threaten a man? Will all of you attack as if he were a leaning wall or a tottering stone fence? They only plan to bring him down from his high position. They take pleasure in lying. They bless with their mouths, but they curse inwardly. Selah. Once again, David is complaining about his many enemies, but protecting him from his enemies is his God. David is at rest. He's not worried about it. He says, God alone, not men, but God alone is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. He's mentioned God as being a stronghold in other of his psalms, his Psalm 99, a Davidic psalm, the Lord also will be a stronghold for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble. Psalms 18:2, another Davidic psalm. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. Now, what was David thinking of when he thought of a stronghold? He's thinking of a high rocky cliff, rocky caves at the top, maybe some rocky towers at the top behind which he could hide. His opponents could not scale the cliffs of that tall stone cliff. And so God is his stronghold, a refuge, a very present refuge in times of trouble, as the King James has Psalms 9:9. Now in verse 3, David says, How long will you threaten a man? Who is the you that he's referring to there? He's obviously not talking about God anymore. Or I should say, he hasn't started talking to God yet because he hasn't prayed to God. Many of his psalms are direct prayers to God, but verse 1, I'm at rest in God alone. He's not talking to God. Verse 2, He alone is my rock and my salvation. He's just talking to his general audience. Now in verse 3, he switches from addressing his general audience to his enemies. How long will you threaten a man? That has to be his enemies. His audience is not threatening him. Will all of you attack as if he were a leaning wall? Who's the he there? Who's the leaning wall? Well, there's two ways you can look at that. As the NIV Study Bible points out, it could refer to David himself as a leaning, tottering wall. He's in a weak state, about to be attacked by his enemies. Or, as Clark and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out, it could refer the tottering wall to David's enemies. In other words, as Clark says, quote, you are just ready to fall upon others and destroy them, and in that fall yourselves shall be destroyed. In other words, we would read it this way. Will all of you attack as if you were a leaning wall or a tottering stone fence? You're going to go down as soon as you attack. I don't think that's what it is. It doesn't sound right to me. That's suggested by Clark and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. I think it's referring to David, as the NIV Study Bible takes it. Well, when was David a leaning wall or a tottering stone fence? Well, it could be when he was young. He was a young and inexperienced king when he was fighting Ishbosheth, Saul's heir to the throne after Saul got killed by the Philistines up at Jezreel, the last battle with the Philistines. And then Ishbosheth took over. Of course, he was a nothing burger, but he had generals, and David had to fight these generals. It could be that, or it could be when David was old. He was a tottering old ruler about to collapse and fall from power when he was fighting Absalom. Remember when Absalom took over the kingdom and ran David out of town? Again, these Psalms, we never know the historical context. It's only speculation. But the point is David was weak when he was attacked, but God was strong and gave him a refuge in the time of his weakness. Now, David calls himself, assuming that option is correct, David calls himself a leaning wall or a tottering stone fence. The NASB just has a tottering fence, which didn't make any sense to me. But the Holman Christian Study Bible has a tottering stone fence, which makes a lot of sense because the stone is about to fall over. Another kind of fence won't fall over, a wooden fence or wire mesh fence, which they didn't have back then, but that's what I picture. Of course, because I can't help it, because that's what I'm used to seeing fences that way, but a stone fence can fall over. Verse 4, David says, they only planned to bring him down from his high position. David's high position, he was king, and his enemies were trying to take the kingdom away from him. David's enemies take pleasure in lying, David says in verse 4. They bless with their mouths, but they curse inwardly. In other words, they're first-rate hypocrites. Selah, which nobody knows what it means. It probably means a pause in the singing. So we go now to verses 5 through 8 in Psalm 62. David continues. He's talking to himself now. He says, my soul, wait in silence for God only, for my hope is from him. He only is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. I shall not be shaken. On God my salvation and my glory rest. The rock of my strength, my refuge is in God. Trust in him at all times. O people, pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. Selah. Now David tells us in verse 5, tells himself actually, he says, my soul, wait in silence. Now what does wait mean? Does that mean wait in misery? Wait in impatience? No, it means wait in confident expectation of the future and confident expectation that God was going to deliver him. John Gill says of this word wait, quote, the grace of patience is from the Lord. The means of it is his word, and it is exercised, tried, and increased by affliction sent and sanctified by him. And expectation is nothing else than these graces in exercise, a waiting patiently for things hoped for. Old Testament saints expected the first coming of Christ. New Testament saints expect his second coming, and all expect good things from him in time and eternity. Nor shall their expectation fail and perish, and therefore is a reason why their souls should wait only on the Lord. Well, Gill is so eloquent. He's exactly right. We've got to wait. I am waiting right now for deliverance from the enemies of Christ who have gotten their stranglehold on America and the culture and the schools and the politics and everything. It would be so nice to live somewhere where people love God in the majority culture like it used to be. Like it never was in China, but wouldn't it be great if there was a Christian culture in China? But even without the Christian culture, there's the Christian church. They might be marginalized and demonized, but they are still leavening the world, as they are in China, in Africa, in India. And there's still a few of us left in America doing the same thing. Now David says he's going to wait in silence. He tells his soul, wait in silence. There's no use moaning and groaning about the situation. It's bad, but just shut up, quit complaining, and wait for God in confident expectation. Why? Because your hope is from him, David tells himself. His hope, and hope means confident expectation of the future. It's like, wait, what you're waiting for? You're waiting for your hope, your confident expectation of what's going to happen. Verse 6, David says, God only is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. Now, that's one of David's favorite metaphors. In fact, he's just repeated what he said in verse 2 of this Psalm 62. David says that he, God, only is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. I shall not be greatly shaken. And again, the stronghold is a rocky stronghold, as I've stated, high up there on the cliffs. Verse 7, David says, on God my salvation and my glory rest. Now, David states that he has glory. After all, he was a king, and kings have glory, but it's only a derived glory. It's only a temporal glory. He gives God the credit for his glory because his glory rests on God, as well as his salvation. And of course, that salvation is probably not eternal salvation. He's probably just talking about temporal salvation from his enemies. And then at the end of verse 7, David calls God his rock. Again, the rock of my strength, my refuge is in God. Now, here's some other scriptures where David uses the rock metaphor as being a refuge. and a stronghold and strength and salvation. Psalms 18:2. All of these are Davidic Psalms. Psalms 18:2, the Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. Psalms 40, verse 2, He, that's God, brought me, David, up out of the pit of destruction, out of the miry clay, and he set my feet upon a rock, making my footsteps firm. Psalm 62:2, that's the verse I just read with regards to stronghold. Now let's look at Psalm 62, verse 2, as regard to God being a rock. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. I will never be shaken. And verse 6, the previous verse in this Psalm 62, He, God, alone is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. I will not be shaken. So David repeats that a good bit. God is a rock. He's a refuge. He's a stronghold, and he is salvation. And this life is very difficult, and we need to remember all of those facts that David speaks confidently to God, and we ought to speak the same things to God as we pray. We go now to Psalm 62, verses 9 through 12, and we will finish this audio. David says in verse 9, Men of low degree are only vanity, and men of rank are a lie. In the balances they go up. They are together lighter than breath. Do not trust in oppression, and do not vainly hope in robbery. If riches increase, do not set your heart upon them. Once God has spoken, twice I have heard this. That power belongs to God, and loving kindness is yours, O Lord, for you recompense a man according to his work. Now in verse 9, David uses Hebrew parallelism to contrast men of low degree and men of rank. Men of low degree are common people, men of rank are nobility. It doesn't matter though whether you are a man of low degree or a man of rank, a noble, because you're both worthless, David is saying. If you are of low degree, you are vain, you are foolish, you are worthless. If you are of high degree, you are a lie. The Holman Christian Study Bible has you are a vapor. You are a nothing burger. John Gill says of men of high rank, nobles and big shots. Well, I'm paraphrasing Gill. He wouldn't use the term big shot. Nobles and big shots trace their origin back to Adam just like everybody else does, despite all their talk of their birth and their lineage. I come from the South. The American South, and how many times have I heard, oh, that family is of a good stock. Oh, you want to marry that girl? She's of good stock. I remember I was told one time that a girl I was chasing was not of good stock because her uncle was a house painter. Of course, her father was mayor of my town, but that didn't matter. Excuse me if I get a little worked up over this attitude of big shots, thinking they're big shots just because they came from somebody. And boy, if you read medieval history, they were constantly... These nobles were tracking them, their lineage and their genealogy back to some big shot in their history. Vanity, vanity, and striving after the wind, as Solomon said in the book of Ecclesiastes, one of my favorite books. At any rate, David is saying everybody is foolish, everybody is vain, everybody is a lie, whether they're low-born or high-born. In the balances, they go up. In other words, on the right side of the scale, you put righteousness, wisdom, kindness, goodness, character, and you put the bad guys on the other side of the scale, and guess who goes up? The men of low degree and high degree who are foolish and vain and vapors, they go flying up because they're too light. They can't hold down. They can't weigh down the goodness, the righteousness, the character that's on the right side of the scale. It's a great metaphor. They are together lighter than breath, David says at the end of verse 9. Here's some different translations for that. Psalm 62, verse 9 in the KJV, Surely men of low degree are vanity, and men of high degree are a lie. To be laid in the balance, they are altogether lighter than vanity. So if you add vanity and lies together, you get less than vanity. They're lighter than vanity. That's the way the KJV translates it. You put the low-born and the high-born on one side of the scales, and they're worth less than vanity. They weigh less than vanity. They have as much constituency as vanity does, except less than that. The NIV has low-born men are but a breath. The high-born are but a lie. If weighted on a balance, they are nothing. Together, they are only a breath. That makes more sense than the KJV, because you put them, the low-born and the high-born fools, on one side of the scales, and the other side, you've got some weight. I assumed it was weight of goodness, nobility, and so forth. Doesn't matter what it is. These low-born and high-born liars, vapors, will go flying up into the air because they're nothing. They're only a breath. Now, David says in verse 10, "Do not trust in oppression and do not vainly hope in robbery." He's obviously talking to evil people who think they're going to get rich by robbing people. And that's pretty much obvious. But then he says in the last part of verse 10, "If riches increase, do not set your heart upon them." You could say, well, if the robber increases his riches, he shouldn't set his heart upon them. And that would be a reasonable interpretation. But I prefer to just think that David was saying that even if riches increase, honestly, don't set your heart upon them. There's nothing wrong with riches increasing if you don't rob people to make your riches increase. Let's say that you're a good business person or you're a good investor or whatever, you're a hard worker and you start making more money than you had before. That's fine. God causes things to grow and bear fruit. There's nothing wrong with a business making money. But there's two things that are hard. One is to make the money, and two is when you do make it, to realize that it was God that made it for you and it wasn't you that did it. And remember, what God did, he can undo at a moment's notice. I love the Roman god of wealth. His name was Plutus. That god, when he was approaching you, he was lame. He could barely walk. But once he got past you, he had wings and he flew away. The object lesson of that god, of course, was to say that money is hard to come by, and once you get it, it's easy to go. Look at all those NBA players that were fabulously wealthy, and within a year they're bankrupt because they're too busy buying airplanes and boats and houses and just being, or gambling and just being stupid. That's a great verse. When riches increase, do not set your heart upon them. It's real easy to do that. The love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. Now in verse 11, David says, "Once God has spoken, twice I have heard this." That's the Hebrew way of saying, I'm really listening to God. Because if you take it literally, if God speaks once, how are you going to hear him twice? Basically what he's saying, God speaks it and I heard it intensely. I heard it deeply. It went into me twice. Power belongs to God. That's what God has spoken and David has heard twice. Power belongs to God and loving kindness is yours in the first part of verse 12. Well, in order for God to do works of loving kindness for David, he has to have power. And he does, because David says power belongs to God. And that's something we tend to forget. We think about loving kindness and we think, isn't that great? God is gentle. God is kind. He loves us. And we don't associate that with power because they seem to be sort of contradictory. But remember, God has to be powerful to overcome the evil that's in this world. And he is. And he's willing to exercise that power on your behalf. In fact, David says that at the end of verse 12, where he says, "For you, God, recompense a man according to his work." In other words, if you're a robber, you're going to get recompensed that way. But if you follow God and do his works, you're going to be recompensed according to those works. He's going to reward you for your good works. He won't save you because of your good works, but by golly, if you do good, if you give to the poor, if you help a little old lady across the street, if you help somebody in need in time of trouble, little things, big things, whatever, if you are looking out for other people and cease focusing upon the Almighty I, God will reward you for that. He really will. And David says that. And again, David ends his psalm on a happy note. We're finished with Psalm 62, and now we are prepared to go in our next audio to Psalm 63, which I will entitle My Soul Thirst for You. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.